The Budget Implementation Act is an annual bill that comes before Parliament and outlines what legislation must be put in place for the government's budget to pass. The Conservative government introduced its bill at the end of March. Bill C-38 is 452 pages long and amends, repeals, and creates nearly 70 different acts. The opposition is calling Bill C-38 a Trojan horse. They say it deals with dozens of subjects that have nothing to do with the budget, from abolishing the need to protect fish habitat, to weakening employment insurance coverage, to attack the work of charity organizations. The NDP decided to hold budget hearings across the country to explore some of the issues hidden in the budget. Jane Williams went along to the public hearing on May 22nd, here in Vancouver, and recorded the evening's events. She joins me in the studio this morning to share some of what she heard. Hello, Jane, and welcome into the studio you're in most Saturdays.
Hello, Peter.
What was the format of the hearings?
Well, I actually wasn't sure what it would be. I couldn't get an impression from the publicity, but I decided to just head on down there with my recorder anyway. And when I got there, they explained that it would be like the format of a committee hearing, a parliamentary committee hearing. The NDP says that Parliament's 25 committees have been sidestepped. So they said, okay, well, we're going to take the committee hearing format, we can take it out into the public. And what happens at a committee hearing is that you have expert witnesses come along and they give presentations on whatever legislation is being discussed, and then the MPs ask them questions. So that's what happened, essentially. There were 7 expert witnesses, and there were MPs there, and then the little twist that they added was that the public could also ask questions. So the format was there were 3 witnesses, and then there was a question period, and then there were 4 more witnesses, and then there was another question period.
And did it draw many people to attend?
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of people there. It was actually a standing room only crowd. They had it in one of the, well, actually 2 of the smaller rooms of the Vancouver Public Library put together, the Alma Van Dusen and the Peter Kay Room, for people who know the library rooms. And it was, there was a lot of people there, a lot of familiar faces to me, a lot of people who were activists from the community.
How about from the NDP? Who was there from the NDP?
Well, there were several politicians and former politicians in the audience, and they were introduced and you know, stood up and acknowledged people. But there was, in terms of on the panel who were going to be asking questions, there were 3 local MPs, Peter Julian, Finn Donnelly, and then Don Davies was chairing. Pat Martin was there from Winnipeg, and Charmaine Borg was there from Terrebonne. Terrebonne is just north of Montreal, and she's one of the 5 McGill students. She was a student in political science and Latin American studies who was elected in the last election for the NDP.
So where did the evening start out?
It started out with pipelines, the pipelines in BC's north. And the speaker was Robin Allen. She's an independent economist, and she was former CEO of ICBC. And she talked about the economics as well as the environmental aspect. I guess she's been assessing the economics of the Northern Gateway project for the last 8 months.
Okay, so we're going to listen to her. Here is Robin Allen, former CEO of ICBC, currently working as an independent economist, recorded at that NDP budget hearing held in Vancouver on May 22nd.
Included in the bill is the new Environmental Assessment Act and substantial amendments to the National Energy Board Act. These changes limit the participation of concerned citizens. They limit the scope and the number of environmental assessment reviews, speed up the process, and it gives federal cabinet final say for pipeline approval. By gutting environmental review, the Harper government has handed over Canada's national energy security to multinational oil companies and national oil companies owned by foreign governments. Since its establishment in 1959 as a quasi-judicial independent board, the National Energy Board has had the authority to rule on projects following a scientific and economic review of the evidence that was presented by both proponents and opponents to a project. This will no longer take place. Federal prerogative will determine if a pipeline is to proceed, regardless of its economic or environmental consequence. Stripping away independent oversight strips away the credibility of the National Energy Board. Environmental assessment becomes a rubber stamp for projects given the go-ahead and closed-door meetings with lobbyists or during trade mission dinners with leaders of foreign governments. What is particularly unsettling is Northern Gate will fall under federal cabinet decision-making authority. There is no grandfathering of legislative amendments. They apply to all National Energy Board applications in process, not just the applications yet to be filed with the board. We already know the federal government's decision on Northern Gateway. The Harper government has approved this project. By publicly declaring the project will go ahead, and by rushing to ensure its authority to do so, the federal government has made a travesty of the review and a mockery of the good faith all parties have brought to bear on this process. For almost 2 years, the government of Canada has presented Northern Gateway as an economic benefit because higher crude oil prices will be achieved on the barrels flowing to Asia. Asia pays more for crude oil, producers receive more. That's the economic benefit they presented. What they didn't tell us, and what my research has shown, is these price increases apply to every barrel produced and sold in Canada, and these price increases will be passed on to Canadian consumers and businesses. When I filed my evidence in January with the National Energy Board, Enbridge confirmed this is the intent of the pipeline, that this is what is behind their economic benefits case. According to Enbridge, the economics of Northern Gateway only work if the price of oil goes up by $2 to $3 per barrel in Canada on every barrel every year for 30 years, a price increase over and above what would take place if the pipeline is not built. Now, other studies, often cited by Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver, predict, in fact, an increase in the price of oil by as much as $13.60 a barrel because of Northern Gateway. But whether it's $2 or $14 a barrel, according to the industry, the price of oil goes up more in Canada with the pipeline than without it. Of course, what the industry and the government does not tell us is that the impact these price increases have on the Canadian economy as families adjust and cut back in other areas or go deeper into debt. They do not tell us that when businesses face higher energy costs, they cut in other areas like wages or postpone investment, and that leads to slower growth, and then they have to resort to downsizing and layoffs. The capacity of Northern Gateway, we've been told, is 525,000 barrels a day of crude oil flowing along the pipeline to Kitimat, and 193,000 barrels a day of condensate flowing along a pipeline in the other direction towards Alberta. This volume represents 220 oil tankers a year navigating the difficult and vulnerable Douglas Channel in order to pick up the raw crude and drop off the toxic condensate. Condensate is necessary to mix with oil sands heavy oil called bitumen because unless it's upgraded in Alberta, bitumen is too thick to flow through the pipeline unassisted. What most people don't know, although it's been filed with the National Energy Board and confirmed in Enbridge documents, Northern Gateway is actually designed to carry 60% more crude oil and 40% more condensate than we've been led to believe. And the supertankers needed to transport this greater volume? Well, it's not 220, it's closer to 340 tankers a year, almost an oil tanker a day in BC's northern coastal waters. More crude, more condensate, and more tankers means more risk, way more risk. Last month, Kinder Morgan announced a twin pipeline along its Trans Mountain route to transport bitumen to Asia. This new pipeline means an increase from 71 crude oil tankers a year in Burrard Inlet to one oil tanker a day. Once Kinder Morgan tables its detailed pipeline plans, thank you, with the newly streamlined National Energy Board, it's possible we'll find their pipeline is capable of carrying much more crude, just like with Northern Gateway. So with Northern Gateway and Kinder Morgan, this could mean almost 2 million barrels a day of crude oil flowing through BC. That translates into a total of about 800 crude oil tankers a year in BC coastal waters, and none of this will be under environmental assessment. Any insurance underwriter will tell you accident frequency increases with density. More than two crude oil tankers a day is very dense. Supernatural British Columbia becomes a super oil tanker terminal for Alberta. And of course, the rapid extraction and export of raw crude oil puts pressure on the Canadian dollar. And despite name-calling in the media by pipeline supporters to deflect the issue, the rapid extraction and export of raw heavy oil called bitumen without upgrading in Canada artificially inflates our dollar. This undermines not only the viability of industries in BC like tourism and fishing, which will already be struggling to deal with the crowding out from crude oil tanker traffic, but many other sectors across Canada, such as manufacturing, agriculture, forestry, they are also unnecessarily challenged. If we want to mitigate the negative impact on our currency of a rip it out of the ground and ship it along the pipeline strategy, all we need to do is ensure that bitumen is upgraded in Canada before it's shipped to new markets in the United States and Asia. Now, Canada may be an oil exporter, but it's also a major oil importer. Almost 50% of our crude oil is imported from volatile and uncertain markets, many of the same markets the U.S. and China are trying to protect themselves from by sourcing our crude oil. Eastern Canada is almost entirely dependent on foreign imports. As long as this dependency exists, talk of Canada as an energy superpower, as appealing as it might sound, is simply propaganda. So we need to ask, who's looking after the Canadian interest? Who is going to make sure value is added in Canada, that meaningful jobs are created and labor standards are maintained, and that bitumen is extracted and upgraded in an environmentally sustainable manner? Mr. Harper's not. Mr. Harper is not behaving as the Prime Minister of Canada. He's behaving as the Prime Minister of Alberta. That is why, as soon as Minister Oliver announced the federal government's intention to usurp National Energy Board authority with the new legislation, I wrote to BC Premier Christy Clark. In June 2010, the provincial government signed an environmental assessment equivalency agreement, which gave away our right to environmental assessment under the BC Environmental Assessment Act. BC agreed to accept the findings of the National Energy Board review process instead. Now, there was reason to believe that the board's process would be suitably rigorous and objective, that it would provide a fair and just determination in our public interest. With the federal government's actions, with the new legislation, this is no longer the case. In the equivalency agreement, however, there is a clause, Clause 6, that allows BC to terminate the single environmental review process and undertake its own environmental assessment with 30 days written notice. In my letter, I urge Premier Clark to take back BC's sovereign right to environmental review. She's yet to respond. Not only has our Premier been silent on her stand with respect to Northern Gateway, the BC government has not participated in the review process in any meaningful way. The government of British Columbia has not even submitted written evidence to the National Energy Board for consideration. This is why we here in British Columbia, until there are government changes in Ottawa, have to ensure that the province of BC protects our economic and environmental public interest. We need to do this by taking back our right to undertake our own proper environmental review of Northern Gateway and projects like it, particularly Kinder Morgan's. Thank you.
That was independent economist Robin Allen, recorded at the Vancouver Public Library on May 22nd. Jane Williams recorded the event, and she's here in the studio with me. It's interesting to hear about the economics of the Northern Gateway project. We hear so much about the environmental aspect. It gets presented as a jobs versus environment kind of issue, but it sounds a lot more like it's bad for the environment and bad for jobs.
Yeah. And there'll be more about that later on when Robin Allen responds to a couple of questions from the audience. She goes into more detail about that jobs aspect of things.
Who was up next?
The next person was Art Kube, and he's president of the Council of Senior Citizens Organizations. And at this point, for me, I was getting a sense of déjà vu, because the last time, really, I think I heard Art Kube speak was almost 30 years ago now. He was president of the BC Fed, and he was president of the Fed at the time that Bill Bennett brought in a restraint budget in 1983, and there were 26 bills, and that budget attacked labor, women, renters, human rights, you name it. So a similar kind of situation. And there was a mobilization called Solidarity, and it was a mobilization on the scale of what's happening now in Quebec. So there were kind of some interesting resonances there for me. Anyway, here is Art Kubé, and he talks about the consequences for labor and also presents a larger picture of the basic unfairness.
The Harper Budget Implementation Bill is another nail in the coffin of Canadian civil society. A federal budget is supposed to address the desires, needs, and wants of the majority of the Canadian electorate. The Harper budget serves only the greed and the neoliberal policies of the corporate elite. What we see in Harper's drive is income distribution in reverse. No increases in the minimum wage, no increases in old age security, but cuts to the departmental budget will result in some program cuts. Budget cuts trump spending by a 7-to-1 ratio. At the same time, we see corporate budget pockets bulging with $500 billion, money to spend on either buying up our own shares or taking over other companies, in either case, not creating a single job. So Harper is giving the corporation a further tax break. This tax break is paid for with borrowed money. Since Harper has come into power, the corporate tax rate has decreased from 20% to 15%, robbing the federal treasury of $10 billion each year. That amount of money each year could have increased the EOS above the poverty line, stopped all cuts, and balanced the budget. At the same time, our corporate tax would be still amongst the lowest in the industrialized works. Back in 1956, government received from corporations 45% of its revenue. Today, it's less than 9%. The Harper budget widens the social deficit in an already stressed civil society. Unfortunately, the Harper budget is trying to hide some of their intentions from Canadians in the 400-page budget documents. Instead of transparency in debate, we see in Parliament breach of parliamentary tradition, limitations of debate. The budget will eliminate many institutions of importance to Canadians. They will eliminate, like the academic program, the elimination of the roundtable on the environment and the economy, the elimination of the board of referees of the unemployment insurance, just to name a few. Because of the lack of any kind of stimulus and the elimination of 19,000 public sector jobs, unemployment will increase. Yes, the Harper budget operates on the reverse assumption that the poor have too much and the rich not enough. This Harper budget is damaging to seniors and the vast majority of Canadians and deserves to be strongly opposed. Just think back when we were young, we fought to establish the old age security, Medicare, full employment, good labor standards, the right to appeal to layperson boards, issues of unemployment and workers' compensation, to maintain tax fairness, and above all, for a civil society that cares for people. All these instruments of a civil society are being slowly eroded. We can say, I'm okay, Jack, or we can reflect when our parents say, my kid's going to have it better, and recognize our responsibility to our sons and daughters and grandchildren and the people who will come after us. Don't they have the right to a clean environment, to good jobs, good health care, education, and retirement with dignity and security? The Council of Senior Citizens Organizations say yes, and we call on all members of Parliament to strongly oppose this budget and call for a budget which enhances and protects civil society in this country.
That was Art Kubé, president of the Council of Senior Citizens Organizations. Art Kubé listed a few of the programs that are going to be cut, and one of those was the Boards of Referees on Employment Insurance. What are the Boards of Referees?
Well, they hear complaints on issues like denial of benefits for people on employment insurance. And they're a three-person panel. There's a representative for workers. There's a representative for employers, and then there's one for the government. And the cutting, well, not entirely cut, but gutting of these boards of referees is in a part of the budget that's been described as being very well hidden in Bill C-38. And it's one of the many changes affecting workers. The next speaker is Joey Hartman. And she's president of the Vancouver and District Labour Council, and she did a really good job of going into a lot of detail about the changes that are going to affect workers.
Okay, here is Joey Hartman, president of the Vancouver and District Labour Council, speaking at a hearing into the federal budget bill recorded in Vancouver on May 22nd.
This is not a job creation budget. Tax cuts equals job cuts. And this budget, in its initial phases, means over 19,000 federal public service jobs will be eliminated in the first $5.2 billion round of cuts. And those jobs, of course, have many, many more jobs in the spin-off effect in the private sector as well. These are jobs that are important to Canadians. They provide services that we use every day, and they ensure that our food is properly inspected, that the environmental protections are properly enforced, all of those things that are being cut away through this budget. This bill repeals two important pieces of legislation as well that apply to federal construction contracts. For contractors who have over 100 workers and receive over $200,000 in federal contracts, there are two pieces of legislation which are being repealed entirely. The Fair Wages and Hours of Labor Act ensures that all federal contracts meet basic floors for wages, and the Employment Equity Act requires construction contractors to comply with the same federal equity laws that all federal workers enjoy, and those two are being eliminated completely. The temporary foreign workers and immigration pieces are also substantial. In recent years, the federal government has made permanent immigration more difficult in favor of huge expansions of the temporary foreign workers and given live-in caregiver programs. These so-called guest workers are expressly prohibited from gaining immigration status, or in the case of the live-in caregivers, are forced through discriminatory steps in order to try and gain permanent access to live in Canada. For prospective immigrants, this bill simply eliminates the backlog of 300,000 applications from people who have been in the queue to try and come to Canada under the Economic Immigrant Program. Their applications have simply been tossed in the garbage after the government went through and picked the people that they wanted out of that list. Everybody else was told they were getting their money back and that they could reapply at their leisure. So they're back to scratch. But to come to Canada now as a temporary foreign worker is being made that much easier, at least to make it easier for the employers. Guaranteed, there's a process called the labor market opinions, which employers are expected to demonstrate to the government that they were not able to fill the positions that they need filled through the existing labor force in their community. And it's gotten to the point where all they need to do is show that they put a postage stamp ad in a local community paper and say, we didn't get any applicants, or we didn't get enough applicants, and that entitles them to receive what's called a labor market opinion. So these used to take about 3 months to process, and employers were pushing and pushing at the government to say, let's make this faster. And so the government is now guaranteeing an answer on those within 10 days of application. So these LMOs, as they're called, remain a prerequisite to obtaining a permit, but the rules around identifying labor market shortages are vague and easily manipulated, as I say. Nor are employers ever asked, would you be able to hire from the existing population if you paid a living wage? And I know from personal experience, my normal job is to be a representative for the Hospital Employees Union, and we had temporary foreign workers brought in on a permit in Victoria hospitals because the jobs that used to pay a decent living wage at $18 or $19 an hour through the privatization process went down to $10, $25 an hour, and no wonder they weren't able to hire people for those positions. So that's a pretty critical question to be asking. So quite the opposite, this bill invites employers to pay a full 15% less than the prevailing wage for the job in the region for highly skilled immigrant workers. This is both exploitive and abusive. And it's likely true that this will soon apply to all temporary foreign workers and will contribute to the downward spiral of wages and working conditions for all workers across this country. And for those who are unfortunate enough to be unemployed, then the EI situation is also being made much more difficult. Only 40% of unemployed Canadians currently qualify for EI benefits, and that's of those who report and are counted in the statistics. In many communities, there's large numbers of workers who have exhausted their benefits and would no longer be entitled. The labor movement has been calling for increased investment in EI retraining programs, but that's fallen on deaf ears. So those workers are no longer given the opportunity to retrain for new careers, or there's no new opportunity within that. Instead, the government seems to think that the answer is to force the unemployed to relocate or be cut off. So Ken Giorgetti, the president of the Canadian Labour Congress, has called on Diane Findlay, the Minister of Human Resources and Skills Development, for an urgent meeting to discuss this and other matters. The other things that we're wanting to talk about with government are some of the other changes for EI. One is a new Social Security Tribunal to replace the EI boards of referees. So currently there are about 1,000 people who sit on three-person panels to hear appeals for EI claim denials. And so on every one of those panels there's a labor person, somebody who's been selected through the labor movement, who will make sure that the claimant, the person who's been denied EI, makes sure that their case is properly heard and, you know, that they use the proper case law and bring forward the questions that need to be asked. That's being completely swept away. As of next year, they will be replaced by the three-person panels. Will be replaced by what we understand will be 39 people to hear all appeals across the country in a new sort of super tribunal. And the guess is that people will be forced to make their appeals online on a computer and that they will perhaps get a telephone call to ask them to make their appeal. So they won't have an advocate. They won't have an opportunity for somebody to guide them through the process. And our understanding from the referees is that most people who go through this really haven't got the first level of understanding of what they're going through and really need some assistance with that. The second one is proposed changes to regulations regarding job search and reasonable offers of employment. And this is one that you've heard in the news quite a bit, I'm sure, and this idea that there's no such thing as a bad job. I think most of us can agree there is such a thing as a bad job. So this so-called quick return to work provision will assign the minister the power to set regulations to define suitable employment for different categories of claimants and to define reasonable and customary efforts to find work. So, of course, our fear is that the unemployed workers who decline to move to another community or who don't want to accept a job that pays significantly lower than the one that they lost or who perhaps want to stay in their work field of work, that they will be cut off EI if they don't agree to the forced changes. And forcing the unemployed to scramble for any available job across the country breaks up families, destroys the social fabric, and creates an itinerant workforce with a downward spiral of rights, unionization rates, wages, and working conditions. Number three, new rules regarding working while on claim. The clawback currently allows a worker to clear about a day of work a week and still hold on to that money. But the proposed changes would mean higher clawbacks, and a worker will have to find a second day of work in order to keep that same level of income. It's about $75 per month. And four, the impacts to changes to pilot projects in high unemployment regions. There's been several very successful pilot projects in the works, some of them for several years now, and this bill will eliminate many of them. Art Cuby talked about the OAS and GIS, and this is one we've known about since Harper let it out in Davos, Switzerland, that they intended to look at moving the entitlement age from age 65 to 67. And so this, of course, is really taking a stab at the most vulnerable people in our society, most poverty-ridden, and most unable to find alternative sources of income. OAS and GIS combined average about $14,000 per year, and that provides about a third of the income for Canadians age 65 and older. By delaying entitlement to age 67, we think this is both dangerous and punitive. Many will simply be unable to work those additional 2 years. We know that currently over 50% of retired workers in Canada have three or more chronic health conditions. That's within the same person, the same body. So they're unable to keep working but are denied OAS and GIS. Their choice could well become, do I eat or do I take my medications? And people in this situation quickly become more sick and in need of health and social services. So it's a complete offloading of the responsibility onto municipal and provincial budgets, because that's where those costs are going to have to be absorbed as those people turn to health and social services in their community. The labor movement has really been working hard to offer alternative solutions for retirement security. These are not the answers. What we've been advocating and meeting with Conservative MPs across the country to talk about is to improve and strengthen CPP and to keep age 65 as the date of entitlement for OAS and GIS. We do not approve of the idea of pooled RRSPs. RRSPs are simply a way to make the financiers and the bankers more rich. But improvement to CPP takes advantage of a well-used, effective, and really affordable system for all Canadians. It costs about 0.4% in administrative fees, whereas a bank will charge about 3%. And that's a big difference, and that comes straight out of the retiree's pocket.
So I'm
going
to have to ask you to wrap up.
Okay. So the Conservatives may favor omnibus bills now, but Canadians across the country are realizing that this truly is a Trojan horse and will fundamentally undermine the values we most hold proud. As so aptly illustrated by the nude painting of Stephen Harper that's circulating through social media, the emperor truly has no clothes. And I say, rather than politely avert our gaze, we need to take this head on and make our opposition clear.
That was Joey Hartman, president of the Vancouver and District Labor Council. I'm here in the studio with Jane Williams. She's brought in some excerpts from hearings into the federal budget organized by the federal New Democratic Party. We've heard from three speakers. Is this the point where they take questions?
Yeah. So there's four more speakers still to come. But at this point, they break and actually spent half an hour. They had questions from MPs and also questions from the audience. And Peter Julian led off. He's an NDP MP in the Lower Mainland here. And his question to Robin Allen was about the value of the dollar and the effect of the value of the dollar. And Robin Allen was the person who started off the presentation. She's an independent economist and former head of ICBC. And she was speaking about Enbridge's pipeline, but she was talking about the economics of it more. So he asked a question, what is the effect and the value of the dollar? And he referred to something called the Dutch disease, which I guess Thomas Mulcair has been raising. So in her answer, she explains what that is, and here's her answer.
The Dutch disease, by definition, is a situation that occurred in Holland when they discovered gas reserves and quickly exported the gas. It created an upward pressure on their dollar as the currencies came in to pay for the resources. What happens when the dollar appreciates is for anyone who exports goods in Canadian dollars, their exports become more expensive, and hence the demand for those goods falls off. So, for example, manufacturing goods in eastern Canada, forestry here in BC, agriculture, all of those sectors of the economy that trade in Canadian dollars are hurt when the dollar goes up. When oil is traded, it's traded in U.S. dollars. So we sell it in U.S. dollars, we get the money in, turn it into Canadian dollars to pay wages and invest in. So when the price of oil goes up in U.S. dollars, that may be good for oil companies. But we've seen in the last decade that there is a direct correlation between the value of our dollar and the price of oil. And as the price of oil goes up, the value of our dollar goes up. And to suggest that that there isn't a situation here with respect to the rapid export of oil from Canada without upgrading and refining it here, to suggest that that doesn't have a negative impact on our dollar is delusional. It does. Now, we can debate how much of that pressure exists, but it does exist.
You said that there were also questions from the audience. What were people interested in talking about?
Well, they were interested in talking about all kinds of things, seniors and the effect on seniors, how to stop Harper, how to stop Bill C-38. I didn't have a mic on the audience, so I couldn't bring you any questions from the audience. But I can paraphrase what somebody was talking about, and then we'll hear Robin Allen's response. So it was somebody from the Carpenters Union, and he was talking about the elimination of the Fair Wages and Hours of Labor Act. Joey Hartman talked about this in her speech, and this is the act that ensures that if a contractor gets a contract from the federal government, then they have to meet certain basic floors for wages. In other words, they can't pay hugely below what the government would pay. So he said, okay, well, I'm putting this together with the pipeline. And he said, I can imagine this situation where the people building the pipeline put in a very small ad in the newspaper and then say, oh, we didn't get anybody, and now we're going to get people from overseas. And then, so he said to Robin Allen, am I being paranoid? And Robin Allen said, no. And then she went on to say this.
About a month ago, Pat Daniel, the CEO of Enbridge, said that PetroChina was interested in building the pipeline because they build pipelines in China. They also own refineries and have a fleet of tanker ships. And it was suggested that because the wages are lower in China, the person that wrote the story said they have 2 million workers to draw on, that there would likely be a very competitive bid. And so the next day, there was a retraction because it was too early to suggest, but the point being that it is quite possible exactly what you're saying, and that the new temporary worker legislation would facilitate that. There is already a problem in Alberta in terms of the number, the volume of temporary workers that come into the oil sands to work is quite a high ratio compared to everywhere else in Canada. And what it does, of course, is it reduces pressure on wages and gets them lower.
The last two clips we heard were from Robin Allen, independent economist and former CEO of ICBC. She was responding to questions at a public hearing on the Conservative government's budget bill on May 22nd. I'm in the studio with Jane Williams, who was at the hearing to record the event. What's up next?
We have at this point four speakers to come. Margot Young, who is Associate Professor of Law at UBC, Peter Pronsus, who's a Department of Political Science at Langara College, Max Cameron, he's at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in the Department of Political Science at UBC, and Rachel Tutt, who's the co-chair of the BC Health Coalition. Now, the second group of speakers were given a shorter time. They were actually limited to 7 minutes. I have cut them further in the interests of covering as much content in this presentation as possible.
So we're going to hear first from Margot Young. What aspect of the bill did she talk about?
Well, she was the first speaker to veer away from the content of Bill C-38 and to talk more about the democratic aspect of it and how the changes were brought in and the threat that they pose to Canadian democracy. So here is Margot Young. And as I said, she's Associate Professor of Law at UBC.
I'm pleased to be here, and I'm also thrilled to see so many of you in attendance. I think that this is a really important set of issues we consider. In specific, of course, we're focused on Bill C-38, which has been described as an undemocratic law, and I would, I guess, clarify the way in which it's undemocratic. I think it's not undemocratic because it amends or repeals more than 60 bills. I think it's undemocratic because of how it does that. And that's an important point, I think, to make, which is that the debate over process and over the enfeebling of democracy and the fact that this kind of essential engagement around significant changes has been displaced out of the House of Commons is not a debate about the content necessarily. We may have many issues to make about the content of the budget, but I want to speak specifically to the process that's involved and to the character of how these changes are being implemented, because I think that that's a really critical set of issues, and it's deeply threatening to Canadian democracy. I want to begin by mentioning what I, as a legal professor who works in areas of constitutional governance and around issues of activism with respect to women's equality, see as three interconnecting features of what makes a constitutional democracy of the sort that Canada has a healthy one. First, we have the institution of judicial review in our system, which is an important, arguably an important mechanism for dealing with issues that are not being adequately dealt with in other arenas. We also have the institution of civil society, which is the ability of groups to advocate, to be informed, and to ensure active debate and dialogue around the important issues. And then we have our parliamentary system. I think it's fair to say that all three of these features are imperiled at the moment in Canada. The interplay between these institutions is critical, but with the undermining, I think, quite intentional and severe of civil society's ability to participate in dialogue and debate, and with the process of hollowing out and bringing about significant change by stealth, or even whatever's worse than that, maybe by drone, we really have a compounding of issues to talk about. I want to focus in on what Bill C-38 represents to me, and it represents to me an undermining of one of the very particular tenets or foundational principles of parliamentary democracy and of the kind of constitutional democracy we have in Canada, which is to say the preoccupation with the legitimacy of the exercise of power depends upon, in our system, forms of democratic accountability. Of course, elections are one of the primary mechanisms for that, but they come rarely. And there's much to be said about how effective and how actually meaningful they are as exercises of democratic input and participation. But between elections, our system also offers the notion of responsible government, of accountability to the elected assembly as a key device of legitimacy for the government, for the executive in particular, and the way in which you hold the executive accountable between elections. And features of the House of Commons in particular as the elected assembly are critical. And these features are the debate that takes place, the committee system, and the informing of the public to know what's going on when the government proposes changes. And these are precisely the features that are being undermined by what's happening with respect to the Budget Implementation Act right now. And so we face, I think, a critical threat to this key legitimation device, or device of accountability, which is responsible government, that the executive is ultimately accountable, arises out of and is accountable to the elected assembly, a mechanism of holding power accountable between elections. And unless we have a House of Commons, a parliamentary system in which there is healthy, engaged debate, there's informed debate, there's ability to tackle issues in all of their particularity and specificity, we don't actually have a functioning accountability mechanism as our very system of parliamentary democracy understands it and demands. So I think I'm probably at the end of my 7 minutes, but I would say that the three features with which I began this presentation are interconnected and all suffer. When one suffers, we see displacement into constitutional judicial review when the political system can't contemplate or won't contemplate critical issues in their debate. And we really see a thinning of democracy and of citizenship engagement and willingness to participate when they don't have the kind of informed debate and the kind of intensive study of complex issues that the notion of parliamentary or accountability through the elected assembly or parliament understands. And so I would conclude just, by saying that these traditions of responsible government, of democratic accountability as it persists not just through the device of elections, but through the habits, the conventions, and the proper processes of parliament are really critical to the health of the Canadian democracy. And it's of great concern that the raft of changes that have been talked about both here and in other places is not benefiting from the sort of process that would make whatever changes the government wants to bring in about proper lawmaking exercises.
That was Margot Young, Associate Professor of Law at UBC, recorded May 22nd at the Vancouver Public Library. We're bringing you an extended report on one of a series of public hearings into the Conservatives Budget Implementation Act, organized by the federal NDP. Jane, who's next?
Peter Prontsos is next, and he's with Langara College. He's in the Department of Political Science. And in his presentation, he also stepped back from the details of the bill a bit to talk about the larger issue of inequality. And particularly, he talked about that when you have an unequal society, what are the effects of living on an unequal society, in an unequal society, on people's health in general. And you'll hear him refer to a book called The Spirit Level, which was written by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. And regular listeners to Red Eye will remember that we interviewed Kate Pickett, and we also broadcast a talk by Richard Wilkinson about the idea of inequality and its effects on health.
Okay, so here is Peter Prontsos from the Department of Political Science at Langara College.
I want to take kind of a broad approach to some of the changes that are being brought down and the reasons for it. Starting with something that's really important, and people are starting to realize that for all of us, the single most important determinant of our health, of our physical and our mental health, are social determinants. The kind of jobs we have, the kind of inequality that we find in societies. This is much more important than what we do individually. Of course, we shouldn't smoke, we should eat well, blah, blah, blah. But the most important thing when it comes to protecting the health of Canadians is to have a nurturing, supportive social environment. One of the key things, and this has been pointed out a lot recently, including in the book, The Spirit Level, is that if you look at social problems like teenage pregnancies, suicide rates, obesity, delinquency, they are all tied with inequality, with economic inequality. It's a very clear ratio. It's been done, it's been seen around the world. It's been looked at in specific U.S. states, for example, that the more we allow inequality to develop, the more it impacts negatively on society. And what I think is happening here, and I'm sure many of you have read Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, that's what's happening here now. By keeping their agenda secret, by ramming things through Parliament, by not respecting, and this was a point that Margot was making, about not respecting the democratic process, they are determined to reshape Canadian society, to roll back the gains that have been made essentially since the Second World War. Even when Harper had a minority government, one of the first things he did was to say that they would not fund any organization that promoted women's equality. The argument being, well, women have equal status, so there's no issue. I mean, that was the excuse. Another thing that I've been involved in recently is pre- and perinatal psychology and health. One of the things that's becoming very clear is that we are most vulnerable in the first 9 months of life right after we're born. Again, this shouldn't surprise anybody. But as you get more inequality, as you get more mothers who are stressed, as you get more toxins in the air, it all affects the most vulnerable of us. There was a study done in the States. They looked at the effects of poverty in children in the United States, and they said that the effects, again, given that parents were stressed, didn't get enough time to spend with their children, didn't have the chance to necessarily buy nutritious food, the results were that there was physical brain damage similar to that of a stroke, just as a result of poverty. Estimates show that for every dollar you invest in children and in families, you save about $7 to $14 down the road in healthcare. So fiscal conservatives are not a good description for the Tories, because if they were really that and they were concerned about saving, tax money down the road, they would be investing in people and in children and in jobs and education and the environment, and they're not doing it. I don't want to overstate the case, but this whole emphasis on austerity, which of course is not just happening here, but is really starting to come in with a vengeance, is basically, I think, the same kind of thing that we're seeing in Greece and Spain that we saw in Ireland, in Argentina, and so on. It's a rollback, again, of the gains that people have made since the Second World War. And it's ultimately, I think it's self-destructive, but it's going to continue until enough of us resist. I don't think resistance is futile. But as Chomsky said, we don't know that we can be active enough, we can be organized enough to make a difference. But we can be damn sure that if we don't get organized and don't get active, then there will be a catastrophe. The last thing I want to stress is that whether we're talking, whatever we're looking at, whether it's medical care, education, old age security, we're a rich country. We have more than enough for everybody. I think it was Gandhi who said there's enough for everybody's need, but not everybody's greed. So never believe the maird that we have to cut back. There's not enough to go around. That's completely untrue. In fact, with the right kind of social changes, we could have a much better society. It's not like we have to sacrifice to save the environment. We have to sacrifice to end poverty. No. With the right kind of social programs, or a real democracy, then in fact we can all, including the rich, have a better life. Thank you.
That was Peter Pronzos from the Department of Political Science at Langara College. Jane, it's incredible how many different aspects of Canadian society are being impacted by this budget bill. You can see why the NDP, the official opposition, have characterized it as a Trojan horse bill.
Yes, yeah. And as you said in your introduction, it amends, repeals, or creates 70 different acts. So it really is incredibly comprehensive. Now, at this point in the evening, we've still got a couple of speakers to go before they throw open the floor to questions. We just heard Peter Pronzos talking about health in general. The last speaker of the evening is with the BC Health Coalition, Rachel Tutch. She's going to be more specific about healthcare. But first of all, we're going to hear from Max Cameron. He's a professor in the Department of Political Science at UBC. He's at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. And as you can imagine, he's very concerned about the effects of this bill. Like Margot Young, he's less concerned, or I'm sure he's concerned about the content, but he doesn't talk so much about the content. He talks more about the process by which it's being introduced. And he talks particularly about the weak relationship between elections and democracy and the role of opposition. So here is Max Cameron, professor in the Department of Political Science at UBC.
One of the arguments that you'll often hear is that, well, the government very clearly presented an option before the electorate in the last election, an option for a government that would be smaller, policies that would emphasize jobs over the environment. Nobody who voted for the Conservative Party could be mistaken about its priorities. They won a majority, and now it's their time to govern. I think that underpinning this view is a mediocre understanding of democracy. In this view, democracy is elections, and elections are war by other means. There are winners and there are losers. And the winners earn the right to impose their policies over the objections of the losers. In the supposedly more realistic understanding of democracy, Parliament has no other function than to form the government and sit back and wait for the next election. It is an electoral college, an expensive adornment, much like the monarchy, but without the dignity. What this misses is that our parliamentary institutions evolved so that the role of the loyal opposition would be a permanent and constructive force in our politics. Opposition without government is anarchy. Government without opposition is tyranny. And parliamentary democracy is an alternative to those two evils. Loyal opposition provides for three things. First, it helps governments. It provides constructive criticism so that governments don't make costly mistakes. Secondly, it spares governments from being blindsided by opposition they didn't anticipate. And third, it enables Parliament to refine and articulate a clearer and higher sense of the public interest. To imagine that all of this can be done with elections alone is naive and reduces democracy to partisanship. Elections decide not only who we're governed, but how we are to be governed. But elections, there are things that elections themselves cannot decide alone. So for example, elections are typically fought on the pros and cons of certain issues, but we often make these decisions in the absence of full information. You could say that the purchase of the F-35 fighter jets was on the table before the last election, but the cost of these jets was not. Whether to proceed with that purchase, then, can't be decided on the basis of the outcome of the last election. Elections are often fought on particular issues, but the relationship between those particulars and general principles is often opaque. Clearly, the government didn't like Kyoto, and we knew that before the last election. But to eliminate Kyoto in a budget implementation bill without providing any alternative on climate change, I don't think they had a mandate for that. Third, elections are often fought on general principles, but where the particular applications need to be worked out in practice. We knew this government was going to promote jobs and seek prosperity through market development, but does that give them a license to build pipelines without adequate environmental review or consultation with affected publics? We can't decide that on the basis of the last election. So for this reason and others, we need the parliament to be an institution that transforms the partisanship of elections into the production of laws in the general interest. Laws that can be interpreted in particular cases by the courts, and laws that give guidance and direction to the policies of the government of the day. And for that, there must be parliamentary debate and inquiry into all matters of law and all major public spending initiatives. It is unacceptable to bundle a massive overhaul of legislation spanning multiple policy issues into a single bill and ram it through the House of Commons without broad public debate. And for Parliament to perform its critical function, it must genuinely be a house of the people. We need Parliament to reach out to civil society and to work to ensure that the broadest deliberation occurs not only inside the House, but also outside the House. Around the world, in over 1,200 cities, democracies are adopting the principle of participatory budgeting. One of the advantages that we're learning through these processes is that by engaging citizens in the policy process, we can transform our political discourse into something more constructive. Partisanship in this country is undermining public trust in our institutions. The government, for example, insists that everything that it's doing, it has a mandate to do and is beneficial and will contribute to the future prosperity of the country. The opposition says they don't have a mandate and what they're doing is destructive. And so we have a polarized debate. And this turns off the public. But what experiences with deliberative democracy can show us, and I use the example of participatory budgeting, is that well-designed processes of public deliberation can improve policy outcomes and generate trust in institutions. Thank you.
And that was Max Cameron, who is a professor at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in the Department of Political Science at UBC. We're listening to speakers recorded at a public hearing into the Conservatives Budget Implementation Act, which was organized by the federal NDP. Jane Williams recorded the evening, and she's here with me with some clips. Jane, you mentioned that a speaker from the BC Health Coalition was coming up next.
Yes, and for people who aren't familiar with the BC Health Coalition, they are a group who advocates for the protection and expansion of a universal public health care system. Now, the speaker was Rachel Tutt, and one of her main concerns was that the federal government, she sees the federal government abdicating leadership in healthcare, like kind of a national central leadership in healthcare. And this is particularly of concern to her because there was a health accord signed with the provinces in 2004, and it's going to expire in 2014. Anyway, she will say more about that. Here is Rachel Tutt, co-chair of the BC Health Coalition.
This month marks the 50th anniversary of Medicare. 50 years since it was first introduced in Saskatchewan in 1962. I'm here today, 50 years later, deeply concerned about the impact this federal Conservative omnibus budget bill will have on our treasured public health care system. And it's hard not to conclude that the legislative amendments contained in Bill C-38 will ultimately erode Medicare as we know it and open the doors to privatized, for-profit health care that most Canadians just can't afford. Medicare is one of the most valued programs in Canada. It's one of the most important ways in which we look after each other. And even though it has been systematically undermined over the last decades, it is still one of the most important ways that we redistribute our collective wealth and ensure that we can all access care when we need it, regardless of our ability to pay. Now, the 2004 Health Accord expires in 2014. This presents an opportunity for the federal government to renew its commitment to national standards and to positive public health care reform. It's an opportunity to improve health care for all people in Canada by establishing national public programs that we all need, such as a national pharmacare program and national home and community care legislation. These programs would not only improve care, they would curb the rising out-of-pocket costs for the services that are not covered under Medicare. But these positive steps forward require federal leadership. The provinces need the oversight and the coordination from the federal government in order to implement the national standards and programs we need. Unfortunately, Bill C-38 makes it clear that the Conservative government does not intend to play that leadership role. Instead, this bill shows us that they intend to walk away from the healthcare table altogether and reduce their healthcare responsibilities to a mere fiscal arrangement. Now, to be a little more specific, here are some of the ways that the budget bill will have an impact on public healthcare. First, it's apparent from reading Bill C-38 that there will be no renewed health accord after 2014. The reduction in funding proposed in this budget will reverse the gains that have been made since the 2004 health accord. That means that the federal contribution to health care funding will slide back to where it was before the 2004 accord, opening the door to privatized for-profit health care and providing the grounds for breaking Medicare, for two-tiered health care. Basically, Bill C-38 reduces Ottawa's role in health care to check writing. With no strings attached to the funding, the federal government will not be able to take leadership in developing meaningful national standards and coordination. We're unlikely to see a national pharmacare program or national standards for continuing care or for anything else. The Harper government is essentially telling the provinces to figure it out on their own. With no national leadership, no coordination, and with downloaded costs on their backs. Finally, Bill C-38 makes significant cuts to the interim federal health program, which will result in many refugees in Canada losing access to primary health care services and to medications they need to treat their illnesses. These are people that have sought refuge in Canada. Denying them health care is both cruel and unethical. Poll after poll shows enormous public support for our public health care system. People have a right to know what is being done to this system, a system which reflects the values of equity and equal access that means so much to us. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be part of this hearing tonight so that more people will have the chance to hear about what is being done to our public healthcare system. Thank you.
That was Rachel Tutt, co-chair of the BC Health Coalition, speaking on May 22nd at a public hearing on Bill C-38, the Harper government's budget bill. So at this point, we've heard from several different speakers, lots of information to absorb, but it seems like the overall picture is pretty clear that this is way more than a budget. What happened when the floor was opened up to questions again?
Well, once again, Peter Julian went first, a local MP, Peter Julian, and he started out by saying that there's a four-letter word that the Conservatives don't like, fact. And he talked about the elimination of the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy, the elimination of the First Nations Statistical Institute, the National Council of Welfare, reduced funding for StatsCan. So all these groups that gather facts. And then he wanted to ask the panelists to respond to what the ramifications are of eliminating the ability to gather facts to base policy on. And in this next clip, we're going to hear first from Margot Young and then from Peter Pronsis.
It's a tough question because it's such a critical question. And the answer is, so I think apparent, the consequences are tremendously distressing. And you know, my colleague Max Cameron has done a wonderful job of spelling out the importance and the critical character of deliberative democracy. And without the facts, with bad policy making, with policy-driven facts as opposed to fact-driven policy, we don't have the kind of informed, critical, deliberative debate that actually not only makes better policy, but also engages a citizenry and results in a meaningful, substantive democracy.
In addition to the attack on democracy, I think the other reason they're so afraid of facts is because facts contradict their positions. They're, you know, whether we're talking about science or social policy or whatever, the facts contradict what the Tories are trying to do. I was at the Association for the Advancement of Science conference just a couple months ago here, and there was international press coverage about how scientists are being muzzled in Canada, especially when it comes to things like the environment, because they do not want to hear about the facts which show what they're doing and what they're planning to do and the effects of that on Canadians and the rest of the world. So facts are anathema to them for obvious reasons.
That was Peter Pronsos from the Department of Political Science at Langara College. Before him, you heard Margot Young, Associate Professor of Law at UBC. Jane, was the floor opened up to the public at some point?
Yeah. So, and there was, there was a very long line of people at the public mic. I mean, there were so many different aspects that affected so many people in different ways. And as you can imagine, I mean, we'd sat through seven speakers talking about all the different ways in which this budget implementation bill is changing the nature of Canada as we know it. So people were extremely angry, very frustrated. There was a scientist who stood up and said she's been a practicing scientist for 20 years and she was, I think she used the word, scared of doing her job at this point. At least a couple of people who spoke wanted the NDP to walk away from the House, to actually refuse to participate. One man said that Canada at this point felt to him like Germany in 1933. So people were very, very angry. I want to share one last clip, and this is in a response to a woman who wanted to know what panelists thought that people should do, and that was certainly something that was coming from the room. It's like, what are we going to do? And you'll hear Rachel Tutt first from the BC Health Coalition and then followed by Margot Young again.
I believe what we need is a vision for people to believe in. We need to be able to believe that there is an alternative and that the myths that we are being fed are just that, they're myths. We are constantly being told that our healthcare system is unsustainable. This is not true. With leadership, real leadership, we can have positive public reform that will improve both the sustainability and the quality of our public healthcare system. These are the basic values that we have to look after each other. And with good vision and good leadership, we can have this. And in this budget, the federal conservatives are abdicating that leadership. And we need people from all of our society to stand up and take back that leadership.
I also want to say that I think the civics lesson is actually really critical to the budget, because the budget raises two sorts of concerns. The first is a set of concerns about the content, what those legislative changes are. And that's a very important discussion. But the concern that I think principles of democracy speak to is the concern about how those changes are being implemented. And every Canadian, regardless of what she or he thinks about the content of those changes, should be concerned about how those changes are being brought about. So it is a concern about civics, as well as a separate set of discussions around the content. And I think they feed into each other. I think some of those content changes further undermine possibilities for the kind of debate and discourse we want to have in a healthy democracy. But I think to keep those two distinctions, two separate critiques of the budget legislation at issue now, separate is actually also really important. And I think people should be clear that everyone, regardless of your politics, should be concerned about changes happening this way.
Jane, where is Bill C-38 right now in the parliamentary process?
Well, it passed second reading a couple of weeks ago, so before these public hearings. And then once it's passed second reading, it goes into committee. In the House of Commons, it's in the Finance Committee, but they've also struck a subcommittee to look at the environmental aspects of that bill. It's going to committee in the Senate at the same time, and my understanding is that they've split it among several different Senate committees, the idea being that they pass it through those committees so that as soon as it passes in the House of Commons, they can get it into law. The Senate will almost automatically pass it into law. When it comes back after the committee hearings, when it comes back to the House of Commons, Elizabeth May has said that she will fight it. The Greens don't have official party status. And I guess in return for not having official party status, they have the right to propose an unlimited number of amendments to any bill with the support of five other MPs. And the Liberals have agreed to do this, to support it. So then what Elizabeth May has said that she will do is that she will keep proposing amendments. And she says each amendment takes 15 minutes. So if she can propose a sufficient number of amendments, then she can get it stalled, kind of filibuster it in a sense. And the House rises for the summer on June 22nd. So I guess the effort is to not allow it to pass before that House rises for the summer.
And I understand there's also an effort to persuade 13 Conservative MPs to actually vote against Bill C-38 and try to get it split up.
Yes. I don't know if people are aware of the fact that there was a Conservative MP. He's an MP, David Wilkes. He's a new MP for Kootenay, Columbia. And he was videotaped in a conversation in his constituency office. People were coming with their concerns about the bill, and he said that he would oppose the bill, and if there were other people who would join him, and he said that there were other members of the Conservative backbench who were deeply troubled about the bill. Now, this videotape then went on YouTube. Andrew Coyne, who I wouldn't normally quote, said that he's a National Post columnist, he said David Wilkes was taken out to the woodshed, and then he came back and said, oh, no, actually, I support this bill, and I support the jobs and growth that it's going to bring to my area, et cetera, et cetera. So now I'm not sure if it's coming out of this event, but what's happening right now, in fact, happening today, leadnow.ca, they're calling Bill C-38 the black mark budget bill. And they are organizing stands outside the offices of Conservative MPs, asking them to oppose the bill and ask for it to be split into separate separate parts so that it can be voted on individually. And if you crunch the numbers of who, you know, where the majority is for the government in the House of Commons right now, it needs 13 Conservative MPs to vote against the bill. So it's happening mostly at noon, so a few moments from now. Some are happening a little later, like 2 o'clock, 2:30. There's 27 different events in BC. There's 182 across the country. You can find out if there's one happening at your MP's office if you go to leadnow.ca. But if you have a Conservative MP, then there's a very good chance that there is a stand happening outside their office. And of course, you don't have to just go to your own MP's office. You can go to one that's happening in a riding next to you. So that's going on right now. So then, and then I guess we'll see. I mean, the Tories have 3 weeks.
Thanks so much for coming in and sharing these clips with us, Jane.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Jane Williams from the Red Eye Collective. She was talking about the public hearing on the Conservatives Budget Implementation Act held here in Vancouver on May 22nd. If you missed any of her report, you'll be able to find it on our podcast a few days from now.